From LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
The coronavirus pandemic emptied much of Louisville's downtown in March as thousands of workers were either laid off or set up shop at home. Many government functions were suspended and bars and restaurants were placed under restrictions. Later, vandals, taking advantage of those demonstrating for racial justice, broke out storefront windows. Some stole merchandise. Many downtown businesses remained boarded up as a result. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll talk about the state of Louisville's downtown and what the future holds. We'll hear from some city officials and business owners. Plus, we'll get an update on the week's coronavirus-related developments. Call us with your questions and comments this hour as we talk about the future of downtown Louisville on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. In a short while, we'll talk about the state of Louisville's downtown and the future of the urban center following the coronavirus outbreak and the ongoing protest over police violence. And we'd like to hear what you think about the situation downtown, the economic impact, and what should take place going forward. You can call us 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. But first, let's get the latest on coronavirus-related news before we talk with our reporters. A couple of developments from yesterday. As you probably heard, the Kentucky State Fair will now be limited to participants only, and Governor Andy Beshear yesterday extended the mask mandate in Kentucky for another 30 days. Earlier this week, we learned that the Indianapolis 500 will be fans only, and as it stands now, the Kentucky Derby is still planned on September 5th with a limited number of fans. Now, here to talk about the latest with schools, particularly Jefferson County Public Schools, and we're going to talk about Southern Indiana schools as well, is our education reporter, Jess Clark. Jess, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to have you here in person with us.
Oh, yes. Very nice.
Also here in the studio is Jared Bennett from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. He's here to talk about Kentucky's unemployment insurance system, which has been running behind in resolving claims. And he'll tell us about how some recipients are learning that they might be giving some of that money back to the state because they were overpaid. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But Jared, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. Okay, Jess, let's start with you. It's very much a fluid situation with the schools and coronavirus. It can change daily, but let's talk about what we do know. Let's start with statewide. Right now, the governor has asked school districts not to start classes until later this month, right?
Right. So, earlier this month, he asked, or at the end of last month, he asked school districts to delay any in-person opening until the third week of August. School districts are complying with that. JCPS is one of them. Their plan kind of already was they were starting virtually August 25th for students. In JCPS, actually, though, teachers and staff will go back on Monday, and they will have 2 weeks of professional development and training to prepare for this totally brand new way of doing school. The district calls it NTI 2.0, so it's going to be like NTI or non-traditional instruction that we had in the spring, but they're saying it's going to be bigger and better.
Yeah, I know. I have a son in high school, and the NTI they put into place very quickly in the spring wasn't really intense, but I mean, it was something that they could do every day. But this time, there's going to be a lot more accountability too, right?
Yeah. So in the spring, the state required districts to report participation weekly. So really, to comply with state law, districts just had to check in, or schools just had to check in with each student once a week. This year, there's going to be a daily participation measure. So each day, schools will have to say, you know, we checked in with the student. JCPS says it's going to be much more synchronous. There's going to be a lot more live sessions, daily live sessions with teachers and students, just a lot more engagement and interaction day to day.
And this is a huge logistical undertaking for Jefferson County Public Schools because there are almost 100,000 students.
Yeah, almost 100,000 students.
And many of them do not own computers, so there's the distribution of Chromebooks, which actually began back in the spring.
Right, yeah. So right now about 20,000 students have Chromebooks that are owned by JCPS. The district has purchased an additional 30,000. So the district thinks that they will be able to be one-to-one in the fall, which is amazing, because JCPS has 65,000 students who are on free and reduced lunch, which means they're low income and are unlikely to have access to technology. So the district is saying it's going to be able to provide a device for every student. The real challenge, though, is going to be internet access. That is a bigger challenge that the district has not solved.
And speaking of free and reduced lunch, there will be meal distribution during this early period?
There will be, yes. It will be just like in the spring, 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, at different distribution centers at schools across the county.
Let's talk about sports for a moment. The Kentucky High School Athletic Association has said sports can proceed. There is a revised schedule and, of course, protocols in place. And will Jefferson County schools be following these protocols?
Unclear if they're actually going to start. So the Kentucky High School Athletic Association says that most fall sports can start on August 24th. At the meeting on Tuesday, board members and Superintendent Marty Polio all expressed a lot of reservations about being able to, you know, stick to that timeline just based on the number of coronavirus cases in the community. You know, we have a positivity rate that's well over the threshold at which the World Health Organization recommends reopening. And so there's just a lot of concerns about, can we do sports on that timeline based on the infection rates in this community? And we've already seen that sports teams, you know, have begun practice. They were practicing as early as July 15th across the state. And we've already seen infections that have started because of football practices, for example.
I know a lot of people have been lobbying school board members to let the sports go forward, but
yes,
that's a tough decision to make.
It is, yeah.
Let's talk briefly about Catholic and parochial schools, because there is a big population of Catholic and parochial school students across Louisville and across Kentucky. Now, they pretty much make their own decisions, but they follow generally the state guidelines.
Right. Governor Beshear's recommendation applied to those schools as well. And so the Louisville Archdiocese says they're going to push back all their in-person start dates to the third week of August to comply with that recommendation.
Well, let's cross the river over into Indiana. You've been reporting on schools there, which they actually began classes, last Wednesday.
They were one of the Greater Clark County Schools was one of the first districts really in the country to go back to in-person classes. In Greater Clark County, you had the option as a parent of either starting in-person or going online. And a lot of parents chose to send their children in person. And, you know, there were a lot of concerns from teachers about that, but they did start the school year in person. There's a mask requirement, so students in grades 3 and up have to wear a mask. That's because to comply with Governor Eric Holcomb's recommendation there. So they've started and they've gone back.
And he is moving forward with the plan that he put into place. I know there's been some concerns raised by the teachers' union, among others.
Right. The teachers' union has raised concerns. I think there, you know, even in the first week, we had 4 cases among students and staff of confirmed cases in the school. And, you know, the health department says those infections didn't happen in the school building. They likely happened in the community. And so they don't believe there's been any in-school transmission, but, you know, it's scary for teachers, especially we had in Pleasant Ridge, for example, the entire kindergarten class had to be quarantined after a staff member there tested positive. And so there are concerns about, you know, safety. There are also concerns about, can we have a school year where we're, you know, repeatedly quarantining classes and coming back, and will we have the staff to be able to teach students in person with all of these quarantines going into effect?
So just to review, Jefferson County Public Schools resume instruction it's August 24th?
August 25th.
August 25th, non-traditional instruction for 6 weeks and perhaps longer. We don't know yet, right?
Yes, yeah. They're going to make a decision. They're going to review the data in September to decide, you know, whether when we get to that 6-week mark, which is kind of like early October, whether we'll continue NTI or go back to in person.
Jess Clark is our education reporter at WFPL. Jess, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jared Bennett from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. Let's turn to you. Unemployment insurance in Kentucky and benefits before we talk about your latest reporting. What kind of progress has the state been making in fulfilling or handling claims for the tens of thousands of Kentuckians who had been waiting benefits since March?
Yeah, so when me and a colleague of mine, Eleanor Klibanoff, had written a story about the unemployment office last month. And at that point, there were still 68,000 claims on a backlog that hadn't been finished up and processed. So that was 68,000 people who haven't gotten any money, you know, since March and for months. Then the governor hired Ernst & Young contractors to sort of help bring those over the finish line, and as of a week or so ago, they've finished most of those. They've completed 56,000 claims, so there's still about 10,000 left. But you know what the governor says is that those are mostly, you know, they need one piece of paperwork signed or one document sent to the office. You know, pretty simple claims that they're just sort of bringing over the finishing line, and now they have actually extended the Ernst & Young contract now through August to sort of finish those things out.
And so much happened at one time with the outbreak and unemployment. There were hundreds of thousands, right, of claims made early on, and the system just couldn't handle them all at once.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the first week where things really spiked, Kentucky's unemployment office went from handling like 3,000 claims and to handling 113,000 that first week. So that's a pretty big jump. A lot of people asking for help and needing benefits that, you know, the system just wasn't set up to process that many at once.
And the numbers come out weekly as to how many people are filing for claims, and they've steadily decreased, I would assume.
Yeah, they've decreased. The numbers come out on Thursday. So yesterday, the latest numbers were released, and Kentucky had about 20,000 initial claims. So that's 20,000 claims filed where people are, you know, filing their first claim, and that's that's pretty steady actually the past few weeks. It's decreases a little bit. It's a small decrease from the last reporting period. But yeah, I mean, we're definitely not at the 113,000 right. People applying at once, but there is still a huge problem with unemployment now.
Got about a minute and a half left. I want to talk about a little bit about what you've been reporting, because some people who have received benefits have had some of that pay docked because of overpayment of past benefits.
Yeah, this is a quirk in the unemployment insurance system that, you know, it happens in every state. Kentucky has some rules that make it especially difficult. If you get overpaid in unemployment benefits, whether you know about it, whether it's your fault, a simple paperwork error, or even a mistake on the part of the state, which is the individual that I had written about, Kimberly Iacono, the state had made a mistake 8 years ago handling her unemployment insurance claim during that time period, and she was overpaid $6,000 that she didn't know about until she went to collect unemployment in March. And, that's a debt that she has to pay back.
And I want to direct folks to your reporting on that, because it's a great story. It's at kycir.org or wfpl.org. Jared Bennett and Jess Clark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll be back to talk about the state and the future of downtown Louisville after a break. This is In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
My name is Amy Kim, and this is Fashion Club. We have been here for 30 years, on the corner of Chestnut. It's been very slow. There's no foot traffic at all downtown. If you look out the doors, it's just sunlight, you know, and you don't see anyone walking, you don't see anyone working, because a lot of our customer base was hotel workers and people that aren't working right now, that aren't downtown. When my parents first came here in 1990, downtown was totally different then. You know, it was kind of dangerous to be down here. But now it's not really dangerous, but nobody wants to come down. I just hope for a lot of change from our government officials and people, local agencies, just getting more people to work downtown, want to help downtown. And I don't know, like, with the coronavirus, it really makes it hard to be hopeful, but we are. We're hopeful that people will get their jobs back and come out and go come shopping or just come look.
Amy Kim from the Fashion Club here in downtown Louisville, talking with our producer of In Conversation, Michelle Tyrene Johnson. And welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Louisville's downtown has seen an unprecedented period of growth in recent years, with hundreds of millions of dollars of investment. Thousands of people have been drawn to attractions and venues downtown like 4th Street Live, Whiskey Row, and the KFC Yum Center, just to name a few. Then came March of 2020 and the coronavirus pandemic, which forced many downtown workers to do their jobs at home. Many were laid off, and that also led to restrictions on restaurants, bars, and other places. Some had recently begun to reopen, but then came the racial justice demonstrations. And during the early days of those protests, a relatively few number of people used them as cover to vandalize businesses, and some stole from those businesses. Many are still recovering from that, and many storefronts are still boarded up downtown. Plus, now there's an uptick in COVID infections, and that's led to more health precautions statewide, further slowing the restart of the economy downtown and elsewhere. And joining us to talk about downtown today and what's ahead for the future will be Rebecca Matheny, Executive Director of the Louisville Downtown Partnership, the coalition of entities that promotes downtown and work to keep it vibrant and viable. Rebecca, are you with us?
I sure am.
Oh, hi, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
I didn't know you were on the line yet. Good to have you with us. Karen Williams is President and CEO of Louisville Tourism, which promotes the city's various attractions and welcomes visitors to the city, among many other things. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rick. Happy to be here.
And welcome to Lamont Collins, founder of the Roots 101 African American History Museum that was scheduled to open on Museum Row here in Louisville back in April, but that was put on pause for obvious reasons. We're going to find out the latest about that and talk to Lamont. Lamont, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you all with us. And a little later, we'll be joined by Mary Ellen Wiederwall, chief of Louisville Forward, the Louisville Metro Government Economic and Community Development Arm. And, of course, we want to know what you think. Do you work or live in or near downtown Louisville? How have the events of the past few months affected you? Do you live in another city or community where downtown activity has been affected by coronavirus? We'd like to hear from you as well. A lot of smaller communities across Kentucky have put forth a lot of effort in recent years to revive their downtowns after a lot of the economic activity moved to the outskirts. But we'd like to hear from all of you. Call us 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. We're on Twitter. WFPL News is our handle. You can reach out that way, and we're also on Facebook. And let me start with you, Rebecca, just to be clear so we'll know what we're talking about going forward. What do we mean when we refer to downtown Louisville? Where does it start and end?
So I think that that's a very relational question. Some people think it starts and ends. There are all kinds of different divisions. We consider the central business district to be from 9th to I-65 and from a couple blocks south of Broadway to the river.
Gotcha. Now, let's talk about where downtown was prior to the COVID outbreak, because that's important, it would seem, to how quickly it recovers. There were a lot of projects that were either just completed or in the works when a lot of that activity was put on hold because of the coronavirus. A lot of things going on. What kind of path was downtown on before COVID-19?
I think we were on a great path, and we had a number of hotel projects that were underway, and there's still a lot of construction happening here, which is, I think, a very gratifying thing. We'd added thousands of housing units, and we were pleased about that, like from not in the last year, but over the course of the last probably 10 or 15 years, we'd added a lot of residential. We had retail moving, and we kept expanding our office space occupancy. Prior to the COVID, we had some challenges in Class A office space, as have people nationally, and that is something that we had been working with our wonderful commercial real estate community on, making sure that we were trying to get ahead of.
So what's the assessment of how things are right now downtown, given the coronavirus outbreak, and which has kind of been overlapped now by the protests that have taken place in a good section of downtown? What's your assessment right now of how things are going?
Well, we obviously don't have the kind of foot traffic that we did when workers were here, and we don't have the kind of vibrancy from public events that we had when those things were happening. What I'd like to say, though, however, is that downtown is not a place that is, I've heard it referred to by all kinds of negative terms. You know, I'm down here every day. I walk around. It's safe. There have been a few isolated incidents of violence since the first two nights of protests. But again, that is not unusual in terms of downtowns across the country right now. Downtowns are always where people gather. They're the heart and center of our community. And so, of course, they're where people are going to come to express their opinions. That is part of our function, is downtown is for all.
Yeah, and it seems there has been some misinformation. A lot of people see things on TV, see a lot of the negative stuff. I'm down here every day too, and it's you know perfectly fine where I am. But what's the level of concern that you're hearing, just economically speaking, from business owners concerned about trying to emerge from the coronavirus and the timeline? It seems like some are saying, you know, we're getting very close to a tipping point where we may not be able to recover fully.
Yes, we are hearing that. We're just not hearing that locally. We're hearing that nationally. I'm hearing that from other downtowns and other downtown organizations that, you know, I don't think that this is, I think that in some ways this economic crisis has sped up some trends that were already out that had been like working from home. Retail has been very much struggling. I'm on the regional board of the International Convention of Shopping Centers, which is the premier retail association. And we've been seeing this nationally, that we know that retail is changing. Restaurants are changing. People's behaviors are changing. And I think the coronavirus has definitely sped a lot of that up.
Let me turn to you, Karen Williams, from Louisville Tourism. You are marking a milestone this week with the return of the National Street Rod Association gathering. I was driving to work this morning, saw a few of them out on the road. Now, that's a long-time event that is back for, what is it, the 51st year?
Well, they've been in existence for 51 years, but, Rick, this would have been their 26th straight year in Louisville.
I see. Now, there was, I think, some concerns raised about having, because there were more than 10,000 of these folks that were coming back. But this is the biggest event we've had, I guess, in Kentucky since the outbreak of coronavirus, right?
That is true. It's our largest event since mid-March. And normally they would have, you know, 10 to 15,000 cars registered. And they would have, you know, probably 20,000 room nights here in Louisville. But we really celebrate all the small wins that we have today. You know, the show is in process now at the Kentucky venues. And they'll probably average about 10,000 registered cars. Some of those will be driving in because we're such a, you know, great distance of one day's drive from so much of the population. I think the airport corridor, I was out there yesterday. Many of the hotels had a lot of the street rides in the East End, a lot of the street riders in their hotels, so we're happy for that. But it'll just be a fraction of what it would have been in prior years.
Are you seeing some of these folks downtown?
You know, normally, even before COVID or the social unrest we have downtown, they really didn't stay in downtown hotels because the street riders like to have their cars in a parking lot that, number one, you can see, you can look out, people can see them driving by. So it was predominantly out in the airport and East End areas. It's just such a great momentum for a city because after the show, which ends at 5 at the Expo, they love to drive out to the corridors. They love to go to the shopping areas. It's a great momentum for our restaurants and attractions because this is their vacation.
I want to come back to you, Karen, but right now I want to turn to Lamont Collins. And before I ask for your thoughts, Lamont, on the past few months, give us a status report on the Roots 101 African American History Museum. And can you maybe explain for those who don't know what it is and where it is and what the status is of it right now?
Well, the status is that we're continuing.
COVID-19 did devastate us a bit as far as our fundraising capabilities and hosting events, but the city has really stepped up. We've done many events in order to keep us going, and even during the time of COVID, just doing it a safe way. The museum itself is Route 101, African American Museum, and it's a story of the African journey from Africa to America. And what makes us unique, we're telling the true story that Africans, or our history didn't start in America. We brought our history with us, which means we're descendants of kings and queens that were enslaved in America. So that's the story we're telling on Museum Row, the history and the contributions of Black America to America, because it's not American history. I mean, it's not Black history. It's American history. We were the back. We were the jackhammers before jackhammers. We were the backhoes before backhoes, and we were the engineers before engineering degrees. So this museum is about telling that story. And when America was at its best, is when we all came together during the abolitionist movement, during the civil rights movement, how every American came together to make us a better place, walking together, working together to make the American dream come true.
And tell me, you said Museum Row, but for those who don't know, that's of course, downtown. And where specifically is that, on Main Street?
Yeah, we're on 819 West Main. We're right beside Fraser Museum, across from Slugger Museum. And the neighbors on this row have been so helpful in making our vision come true and help support us in what we do. So, yeah, we're in downtown Louisville, and no doubt there is it's like a ghost town at this time. But people have always been supportive up to this point, trying to support the vision that we're trying to do.
Well, you're in an extraordinary position right now, obviously, because the issue of racial inequality has been brought to the forefront because of the events of the past several months, including, you know, the death of Breonna Taylor here in Louisville and the subsequent protest. And you're now able to illustrate the origins of racism in Louisville and the many contributions made by African Americans in the community once you get going.
Yeah, it's no doubt. You know, when I was a little boy, I fell in love with the book Tale of Two Cities. It was the best time and worst times. And what this has done for Roots 101 is it's enabled us to tell the importance of pulling the warts back off of America and treating the wound. And the wound is racism. The wound is inequalities. The wound is education. So we can pull that back and dissect it and healed together in the story that needs to be told. So it is the best time for us as a museum telling that story. It's getting corporate America to buy into the story. You know, it's so easy to get corporate America and some people to get involved if you're telling the story of sports and you're just dealing with basketball or gyms. I'm dealing with re-educating young people to when they look in the mirror, they see an image they have not seen before. And that image brings accountability and responsibility to what you see. And that's what we're about. So my struggle has been getting dollars not to feed people, but dollars to educate people. And that's what I'm doing at the museum, is trying to get corporate and philanthropy dollars to support the vision that we have and what we can bring to this city. So it's the best of time and worst of times, if you want to say that.
And you may have touched on it in your first answer, but what do you need, and what are you looking for? What's your goal? What's your dream in terms of being able to open like as you wanted to originally?
Well, originally we were looking to raise $250,000. A lot of that's changed because of COVID, not able to bring income up, so that's gone up a little bit. But we do have the exhibits in place. That's one thing we do have. History-wise, we have all the artifacts here, so it's not like we have to spend any dollars to do that. Our treasures are already here. It's just having dollars to operate now, and that's what we are now. But we fully hoping to open by September. We're going on faith and not finances, and I think, again, that's a struggle that Black people have always moved on faith and not finances, and historically we're doing the same thing, and it's been a blessing up to this point.
Rebecca Bethany, let me come back to you. The protests have reignited discussion about economic equality, black and minority-owned business downtown and elsewhere, representation in the workforce, because that's been a big piece to the protest movement as well. What has the partnership's approach been in this area, and where do you see it going in light of what's happened over the past couple of months?
So I don't think our approach has changed in light of what's happened over the next over the last couple of months, except to be extremely sensitive to where the community is. But we have had a consistent message of equity and that downtown, again, I said this before, downtown is for all. We're so excited about this museum being downtown and adding to our diversity. But downtown is really the community's living room. Everyone comes here. All socioeconomic groups, all racial groups, and that is downtown's purpose, is to be the place where everyone can thrive and everyone can have a place. So I don't think our purpose is served. What we have been doing is trying to support local businesses with understanding some of that, understanding some language, understanding some approaches to welcoming a diversity of customers. I love that you guys opened with the fashion shop, because they are such a hardworking business. They're an immigrant-owned business, and they're a black-serving business. We would love to see more black-owned businesses downtown, and we're working on that very actively and hope to have some announcements very soon about that. Downtown's always been one of the places, besides Waterfront Park, that in our community, I think, is a place where you see a little bit of our entire community. And that is certainly a deliberate intent on our part. I'd also like to thank our partners, because I think that both Metro and Tourism and GLI have all looked at issues of equity in the last several years, so predating all of the unrest over Breonna Taylor. I think that every one of our institutional partners, Fund for the Arts, everyone has been trying to work on these issues for a while. And so that really puts us, I think, in a very positive place.
Lamont, before we let you go, where can people go for information about Roots 101?
They can go to www.roots-101.org. That's our website. And also at the top of the page, there's a donation click. And I'm born and raised in Louisville, so I was here during the 68 riots. So I seen downtown Louisville when it was decimated. This is not the decimation that I saw in 68 and that I grew up with as a teenager. This is something that's fixable and workable, and I look forward to see it come back.
Well, we appreciate you joining us today, and best of luck with the museum going forward. We're going to take a break. We're talking about the future and the present of downtown Louisville on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
My name is Jonas Elmsia, and my business name is Sapphire Mediterranean Deli. Honestly, I am very worried about the future. We don't know how this can last, how long it's going to be, is it going to be better or not. I opened my second location. It was on 5th Street, like a week before the COVID starts. And I keep trying to push it, but last week I closed it. I couldn't keep paying from the pocket like for anymore. Our downtown is really beautiful, and the city been working on it. Now 4th Street looks really nice. The main thing, like, now we got hurt because, like, a lot of offices, everybody working from home. So most of the offices like 20% capacity. I've been boarding up since the protester, started breaking stuff. And then yesterday, we just felt so upset inside. You know, it's like you are in jail, like dark in the restaurant. So yesterday I was like, you know, I'm just gonna open it up and just hoping and being optimistic that things are gonna get better. So I just hope everything goes back to normal.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. And thanks to Jonas from Saphir, a delicatessen restaurant here in downtown Louisville, for speaking with our producer, Michelle Tyrene Johnson. As we talk about downtown Louisville amid the coronavirus pandemic and the ongoing protests that have taken place through much of downtown over the past couple of months, the state of downtown and the future of downtown. And joining us are Rebecca Matheny, Executive Director of Louisville Downtown Partnership, Karen Williams, President and CEO of Louisville Tourism, and I'd like to welcome in Mary Ellen Wiederwall, Chief of Louisville Forward, which is Louisville Metro Government's economic and community development arm. Mary Ellen, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me, and good to be with my sisters in arms here at Louisville, Karen and Rebecca. We've got a traveling road show here.
Yeah, glad you're all with us. And I do want to thank Lamont Collins from Roots 101 and wish them the best of luck with the African American History Museum along Museum Row. Well, let me start with you, Mary Ellen. In addition to dealing with the issues at hand, over the past several months have given us an opportunity to do some self-assessment and plan for that day when we emerge from the coronavirus, and hopefully we're better in other respects in terms of the demonstrations. So what has this time been like for your team from an economic and community development perspective?
Well, we are clearly in a period of great uncertainty with opportunity for dynamic change. Calendar 2020 is not anything any of us expected. You know, I've thought about all the strategic planning that I've been in the last 5 to 10 years that aimed for 2020, and a lot of plans called them Vision 2020. Anybody else participate in one of those? None of us could have envisioned this 2020. And so it's been a really wild time, and it's been a test on all of us as humans, as leaders, and as our organizations. And so, you know, we've all retooled. We retooled when the pandemic hit, and we all had to be healthy at home, and how we were going to keep the economy going. And, of course, we've had some economic downturn to confront. And then now, as a city and as a country, dealing with a long overdue reckoning on race. And so we're just going to do it all. In fact, you know, we launched as a city our recovery platform, Build Back Better Together, at the end of May, right before the protests broke out in our street. And we very quickly decided this was not going to be just a recovery platform from the pandemic and the ensuing economic downturn. This was going to be our community platform through 2020, the resilience that it requires to get through this year and through the pandemic, and our opportunity to come together as a community to dismantle structural and systemic racism. So we have been focused on that and bringing people together and implementing various strategies and tactics to deal with the present and plan for a better future.
Well, I know Rebecca and Karen mentioned earlier that this is not unique to Louisville. This is happening all over the country. And this does, I guess, on the positive side, give you an opportunity to commiserate and compare notes with your peers in other cities, right?
It does.
Yeah, it does. I think we've all been on calls like that, and I'm serving on a national council with other economic developers to talk about what may be institutional racism within our work. And I know that businesses across Louisville and across the country are looking inward and examining policies, procedures, and how can we implement new equity standards in our hiring, our promotion, and the work that we do every day. And so it's a time of great reflection and opportunity for improvement, no matter whether you're looking inside yourself or inside the organizations that you're in.
Let's talk about the Kentucky Derby for a minute. It's still scheduled to be run September 5th with a limited number of fans. Of course, normally the Derby and related events have a huge economic impact on the whole city and region, especially downtown Louisville. Typically run the first Saturday in May, and of course a two-week Kentucky Derby festival leading up to that. Even with a firm date, this seems like it's difficult to plan around because of the uncertainty of the coronavirus and ongoing protest. What's it been like for you, Rebecca, trying to plan around, and Karen, you as well, Karen, with tourism, to plan around such an event during this really extraordinary time?
Well, we're very blessed to have such a great relationship with both tourism and KDF, the Kentucky Deer Festival, and Churchill, where we are in constant communication with them. So what we usually do is a lot of cleanup work, but we've been cleaning downtown every day throughout the coronavirus, and I think we're in as good a shape as we can be for Derby. And I think that, that really this is much more of a, from a logistics standpoint of view, we, besides cleanup, we just kind of manage people. So I will let Karen answer that question.
All right. Thank you, Rebecca. You know, it is true. Derby is on a national, international platform. And so normally a normal Derby, Kentucky Derby Festival, would bring $400 million to our community, $400 million every year in our community. And as I've heard, as we've gone to commercial with some of the restaurants saying they've lost the business, you can think about that $400 million, all that that affects the church from the time you land in the airport to the taxi driver, to the hotels, to the restaurants, to the attractions. Every one of those people are affected by the lack of convention business, leisure business, and, of course, Derby. So we will, we've been working very closely with Churchill Downs and Kevin Flannery and his team. We know that we knew even a month ago the Derby wouldn't look like that it did last year. But as you've said, Rick, the numbers are spiking again. And I think the feeling of people not wanting to perhaps get on an airplane that will wait till next year to come to the Derby and put it, you know, their bucket list experience it next year. And those people are driving in. We're seeing that our hotels, the room nights that we would be experiencing, every hotel being completely sold out, Louisville and Jefferson County downtown. That is not the case to date. And I think as days go on, the hotels that were still had reservations in their hotels, we find that they are canceling. But we will, again, think about the experience of Kentucky Derby. In May, we did a lot of social media with internally and externally, externally to our market, really talking about the experience of Kentucky Derby, not only the horse racing, but the food aspect, the bourbon aspect. And we'll continue to do that. We are dedicated to do that. So, you know, we'll pivot very quickly if Derby changes from here to next week, if it actually happens. But we'll be sure to be on that national platform, keeping our brand alive with the Kentucky Derby.
Are there any the tourist attractions, especially in the downtown area, that are back up and running now?
Yes, actually, and as you said, I've been downtown with you and Rebecca and hopefully others every day, and 80% of our attractions are open. You know, yes, has our attendance been down, but 80% of our attractions and all of the attractions downtown are open. The Bourbonism experience, they are open with different hours and different days of their opening, but all are opening. So we are still messaging out to our local regional audience of having people come downtown to our attractions, as well as all throughout Louisville and Jefferson County. So if people do come here and visit, we do have hotels that are open, and we do have many of our iconic attractions open for them to experience.
I guess one thing that is helpful is the lack of extensive travel, and a lot of folks are staying closer to home during this year, and that's, I guess that's a little bit of of sunshine that you can look toward. Maybe some folks would maybe check out something local that they otherwise wouldn't do.
We do. I mean, we find that we kind of laugh at ourselves sometimes in the office. We really celebrate the small experiences these days. I mean, for instance, in the months of June and July, we would have normally had probably 200,000 people in the city or in our hotels and attendees coming, and we're looking at 4,000 rooms in the month of June or July. But we want to, we're hoping that we'll continue to message to get into that drive-in business. You know, we're one day's drive from 60% of the population. And we find from our travel studies that people do have that pent-up demand, and they want to go somewhere where they feel safe and they can get in their car and feel safe in their hotels and attractions. And that's the type of messaging that our marketing department is welcoming them to our city. Because as you said, you know, in February and last year, we were receiving so many accolades about Louisville. We were that city on fire, safest city, friendliest city, foodiest, you know, city. People don't have short-term memories. They'll remember that, and we will be that city when we get to the other side of this COVID again.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We're talking about the state and the future of downtown Louisville and downtowns in general with Rebecca Matheny, Executive Director of Louisville Downtown Partnership, Karen Williams, President and CEO of Louisville Tourism, and Mary Ellen Wiederwall, Chief of Louisville Forward, that's the city's economic development, community development arm. Well, congressional leaders in the Trump administration are negotiating another relief package. And let me start with you, Mary Ellen. What would you like to see included in this legislation that would help you on your end with the recovery effort and help you, you know, tee it up to really thrive once we emerge from all this?
Absolutely. We need another round of stimulus out of Congress, and that is multifaceted, depending on the agency you work for. But let's start with the big picture, and that's that we are not out of the woods economically. We're going to get some economic numbers today on the jobs report. And, you know, we're just kind of wobbly right now as an economy. A lot of talk a few months ago about whether we'd have a V shape or a U shape or a W shape. The reality is we are not going to come back to where we were at the beginning of this year for some time. And so as a country, we've learned in fiscal policy and monetary policy how we can use those tools to try to make it not as bad. And that's really the overarching reason for having some type of second round here, or depending on how you count it, fourth round of congressional action. And for us in local government, it's giving us more money to fight the coronavirus. The money that we have right now ends at the end of this year, at the end of December. And so we'll have as much as a $90 million hole for the first 6 months of 2021 for just fighting the coronavirus, and so the things that we've been spending those dollars on. And so that's important. And then you're obviously hearing a lot about how the hospitality industry has just been really devastated by this. And so tourism organizations like the one that Karen leads across the country are going to need some relief as well. And some of the organizations like those that are organized as 501c6 organizations and others that do important civic work in communities are going to need help, and people are going to need help. So you can watch the evening news and see all the different categories that they're still arguing about up in Washington. But the main reason is, no matter whether you're looking at it as an individual and am I going to get an unemployment insurance that allow me to, you know, buy food for my family, or you're looking at it as an organization like we are, how are we going to serve the people who we come to work for every day in the city that we love? And then how is this going to impact the macro economy so that we have the least impact that we can have going forward and get into a recovery phase more quickly?
Getting back to the protests, that they've been largely peaceful. As you have mentioned, Rebecca, the first couple of days there was some vandalism, and some stores have remained boarded up because of that. I'm interested in what kind of dialogue you're having with the people who are organizing the protest and the police, and kind of trying to get together and saying, let's see if we can do all this, you know, together, so we can function and we can get out of this coronavirus situation and also better ourselves as a community.
Mary Ellen, I'm probably going to let you take that call, because I think that is something that we do behind the scenes very much, Rick. And mm-hmm. we go through LMPD more than anything else, and we've had a great relationship with them. And we our ambassadors who are on the street, ambassadors tend to be person to person versus organization to organization. So, Mary Ellen, I don't know if you want to mm-hmm. speak to.
Yeah, I'll pick up that baton. The Metro government is addressing this in multiple ways. We have a team of folks who is working daily in Jefferson Square Park and other places across the community with our protest leaders. So the protest is not a monolithic entity. There are multiple groups with multiple leaders and interests, although there is obviously galvanizing interest around the Breonna Taylor case, the resolution of that, and, of course, ending the systemic and structural racism. But we're working with all of those folks. And then LMPD every day has a plan for how they make sure that everybody can peacefully protest and that they also protect persons and property in our downtown areas and then out on the roads when we have the caravanning. There's also a very active presence by LMPD online, as an intelligence unit that's monitoring what's going on out there. And so, you know, as folks listening might hear things on Facebook or somebody might post something on Nextdoor, we're watching that stuff too and looking ahead to what might be happening. And in every case that we've talked about publicly or you've seen in the news, you know, we've had contact with those groups. You know, there's going to be a group coming into town today and then they're going to be leaving. And there's another group that's going to come in town tomorrow, maybe stay a little longer. And so we have contact with these entities and have plans, you know, on the side of working with them. And how can we make sure folks can have a safe and peaceful protest? And then also looking ahead, knowing that this entire community is eagerly awaiting the decision from Attorney General Cameron and having a plan in advance for how to deal with that day and whatever emotions need to come out and make sure there's a safe way to do that.
And one thing I've missed, I come downtown every day, and one thing I've missed, and this is going back to the beginning of the coronavirus, is seeing workers walking up and down the street and going to restaurants and stuff. Of course, a big piece to keeping any downtown vibrant is having workers here during the day. Some businesses may have learned that this working from home thing, you know, it works pretty well. We might just keep it that way for a lot of people. And Rebecca, is there concern that maybe we could lose some downtown workers because of what we've learned from the coronavirus in terms of working from home?
Well, Rick, I would have to say that, like, I don't think that that is something we've learned from the coronavirus. I think that that was a trend that had been happening nationally and with workplaces before the coronavirus. And that, as I mentioned earlier in the conversation, this probably sped things up quite a bit.
Yeah.
This was not something that we weren't going to be dealing with moving forward, period. So I think the real question, and we are so lucky in Louisville that we have an inventive and a resourceful commercial real estate community, that we need to figure out a different way that we're going to occupy that space and how that space can be used. And I have great faith in our commercial real estate partners to help us do that. That I think that the trend from working from home was already happening, and that there were a number of trends already happening that this crisis just sped up. And so it's easier to deal with things if they happen slowly,
Yeah. But
we don't have that luxury right now.
All right.
So,
I'm sorry, Rebecca, we're out of time. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Rebecca Matheny, Karen Williams, Mary Ellen Wiederwall, and Lamont Collins. We appreciate you joining us today on In Conversation. We wish you the best going forward. I want to thank our In Conversation production team as well, Michelle Tyreen Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, Russell Wells, Bill Burton, and our theme was composed by Kojin Toshiro. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.